a broadcast service of City College and the San Diego Community College District. This is Jazz FM 88.3 KSDS San Diego. I'm Dave Drexler with Inside Art. Support for Inside Art comes from the members of San Diego's Jazz 88.3. This week on Inside Art, we welcome one of the most influential vibraphonists and bandleaders in jazz as he enters his centennial year. Terry Gibbs began his career at the age of 12 after winning the nationally broadcast Major Bowes Amateur Hour contest. He spent many years as a drummer and percussionist until falling in love with bebop, which led him to his full-time shift to the vibraphone, where he would thrive as one of the acknowledged greats of his instrument. Throughout his career, Gibbs has played with a who's who of jazz and popular music across many generations, from Benny Goodman and Buddy Rich to Woody Herman, Dizzy Gillespie, and even John Lennon. In 1959, he would form the Terry Gibbs Dream Band, leading a top-notch ensemble of LA-based musicians featuring some of the greatest musical arrangers of his time. Now, a recently discovered previously unreleased recording from 1959 of the Terry Gibbs Dream Band, Volume 7, The Lost Tapes, has just been issued to coincide with Gibbs' centennial celebration. And joining us to talk about his new record and his colorful and distinguished career in music is the legendary Terry Gibbs. Terry, happy birthday and welcome to Inside Art.
Thank you very much. And it took us a while, but we're together on the phone.
Yes, we are. And this new release, I am so struck by how exuberant the band sounds and everybody in it.
Yeah, well, that 1959 band, you know, everybody thought I picked the best studio musicians. They weren't, these are the people who worked, they won the Union Scale one night for $50. Like, they were the jazz players, Connie Cadoli, Carl Fontana, Joe Beatty, all these guys were the jazz players in town. And I didn't want a band at all, Dave. I wasn't looking for a band. I had a quartet and was making a very decent salary, but I had a record day to do. And I got the music with the idea I had about what I wanted on the record. Then I was told that I can't rehearse in the Union because you can't rehearse a record date. Pete Rugolo got fined $1,000. They want you to rehearse in the studio to make overtime money. The Union was stronger. But now then I'm playing at this club. I was playing at a club with Stan Levy on drums, Charlie Eaton on bass, Russ Freeman on piano, and Connie Gandoli and myself one night a week. And then I found out that you can rehearse for a club date that pays $15. So I asked the club owner, how would you like to have a big band that you're paying me for five guys? He said, I don't care. If we don't do any business, I'll close anyhow. So we rehearsed at the club. We set up the stage. We were going to play there that night. And we recorded all day. I expected about 30, 40 people. Steve Allen was a friend of mine then, gave me a plug on the air. We told all the musicians about it. And we recorded all day and then came into to work. And we saw about 30, 40 people. You know, that's what I expected. Went in the back room because we only have 12 pieces of music, Dave. And if anybody understands music, I learned from Woody Herman how to make a song longer by adding solos after things. You know, you learn as you go along in life. And so I took a 4-minute arrangement and made it 11 minutes. Because we had to play three shows. So now we went out to play and we walk out and there were 300 people packed in a place standing room only also. We didn't believe it. We went back in the back room. You can understand these guys, like I said, were the jazz players. And what they used to do with Bill Holman, with write arrangements, and he'd rehearse them as the Union. And then Florrie, they just did it for themselves. Now they're going to play in front of an audience. And so I got everybody come in the back room. And I said this to be silly. I said, we're going to start a band tonight. The first rule is There's no drinking off the bandstand. If you want to drink, you're going to drink on stage. We're going to have a party, you know. Just the one I think anyhow. And so we became an overnight hit. Any song that people always stood up and screamed. You got to understand, at that time, big bands were not in. Little bands like Dave Brubeck Quartet was making as much money as for a quartet as Count Basie was making for a band. I think the only bands going at that time were maybe just Count Basie and Duke Ellington, I can think of them. Woody Herman didn't have a band. Betty Dickard and Audio. They didn't have bands. Nobody had bands. But I wanted to do this album, and the record company fought me. So anyhow, we became an overnight hit, and the club owner says, you want to do it again? So we did it again next week. You want to do two nights? You want to do two nights? So we did two nights. And then he said, you want to go five nights? And I found these tapes that my son put on my computer. And I didn't believe what I heard. I mean, it was a dream band of 1959. And so I called I put together a CD with the help of my friend Rod Negus. He took all the tapes and made me copies of them so I could pick what songs I would like to use, you know? Now, the weirdest thing is that the Volume 6 album was strange also, because after Volume 5, nothing happened for 11 years. And then we had the earthquake in California. Do you remember that all?
The Northridge earthquake.
Yeah, right. And my house was banged up for about $200,000 worth of damage, and I had to move out. And moving back in, you know, everything is thrown out all over the place. This gentleman, Rod Negus, helped me put all my tapes in my closet. And he came over and he says, Harry, I think this thing says Dream Band. So he played it. Done. It was something we had never heard. So I took it to the president of Fantasy, Ralph Cavill, who put out the 5, and he bought that and put out 6. So 11 years later, after 5, now 23 years later, I found these tapes. And this is one of my favorite ones, because Dave, when I go hear a band, I don't want to hear 10 saxophone solos and 25 trumpet solos. I want to hear music. I want to hear the arrangements. I want to hear guys play. And this is 1959. You couldn't get airplay if it was much more than 4 minutes. So I patted my band after Benny Goodman, because he didn't have a section to play with. It was him and the band as a solo here and there. So this is going to be me. And so, but I wanted much more band than Benny had. And I had all my arrangers. I used to arrange, so I sketched everything with them. I want a lot of band here. I want a lot of band. Give me band. I want to hear a band. And that's what this album is. It hits you right in the face. It's like you're sitting in a front row, because Wally Heider, the engineer, was a genius, and he recorded the band.
A lot of credit goes to him for the quality.
A whole lot of, otherwise it would sound like 1959. Nobody would buy it, you know.
Well, he did certainly capture, you know, a balanced sound of that, and that's exactly what you were looking for, wasn't it?
I had to say, when I first hired Wally Heider, when we went into Seville, I always wanted to do a live record, and this guy came in the club, and I heard that he used to go around taping big bands or all kinds of music with his. He was a lawyer who couldn't work. With his father was a big lawyer, made $1 million, but he couldn't work because he stuttered. Wally stuttered. And his hobby was recording. He had all, you know, music. He loved big bands. So I asked him if he would just do an audition tapes, because I just didn't want anybody if I'm going to do a live album. So he recorded us one night, and we went back to his truck, to listen to it after the job. And I said, Wally, I'm going to bring you a record tomorrow. We'll talk about it. And I next day we came in, I brought him a record of Jack the Bear by Duke Ellington, where Jimmy Blanton, the bass player, plays so we have every note. Now, those are were the days only two tracks, so it was hard to pick up each instrument, you know? So anyhow, I said, Wally, I don't know if you can do it, but can you get me to bass the here where I have bing, bong, bong, bing, bong, instead of boom, 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 boom? I can try it. I said, great. And I said, you hear the trumpet? He says, yeah, that's great. I said, no, it's not great. Not what I'm looking for. You got the lead trumpet player sticking out. I don't want him sticking out. I want the fourth trumpet player, the third player, and the second trumpet be at the same level as, so it sounds like a chord. And I want the same thing for the saxes and trombones. He said, I'll give you that, you know. And then I said, also, the most important thing, those days they wanted to feel the drums. No, I don't want to feel them. I want to hear them. Put them up front. You put Mel Lewis up front. And you're not going to get a better drummer playing with a big band in the world.
Oh, Mel Lewis, absolutely.
He was the most loyal member. He was the most happiest guy to have a band I got to play with. With arrangers like on the West Coast, Bill Holman, Monty Page, and Metz Laurie on the East Coast, Al Cohen, Manny Alb, and Bobby Brookmeyer. You know, all in their prime, all about 33, I was about 35, all in their prime. They already had the experience writing any big band in the world. And now they give me what I'm looking for, fire. I want an excitement. I love excitement with a big band. I have all my writers write ensembles, and I want beauty and fire.
And it's all part of the newly released recording of the Terry Gibbs Dream Band, Volume 7, The Lost Tapes. How did you, going back to the formation of the Dream Band, how did you get the name of that? How did you come up with that?
Well, when we first started playing at the club for the first 4 years, it was called the Terry Gibbs Orchestra. And then in 1986, when Fantasy wanted to buy the first album, they called it the Terry Gibbs Orchestra, and the title was Dream Band. So I said to Ralph Galvin, president, no, Ralph, I don't want that title. But I'm no egomaniac. I sound like an egomaniac. Dream Band, boy, that's a title. He said, Terry, that's a great title. We're going to leave it on. Anyhow, that album, first album, made so much noise for us. I'm telling you, Dave, all over the country, it was getting all kinds of airplay. So now when the second album came out, it came out as the Terry Gibbs Dream Band. And every album came out after that, I was called the Terry Gibbs Dream Band. And now when people talk about the band, they don't even mention my name anymore. They just say the Dream Band. And they know it's me anyhow.
We're with legendary vibraphonist and band leader Terry Gibbs, who is celebrating his 100th birthday with the release of a newly uncovered recording of the 1959 Terry Gibbs Dream Band, Volume 7, The Lost Tapes. Stay with us as our conversation continues here on Inside Art on San Diego's Jazz 88.3. Funding for Inside Art comes from the members of Jazz 88.3, where your support brings the joy and history of jazz and all of the arts to San Diego. To become a member, visit jazz88.org/donate. I'm Dave Drexler with Inside Art. This week, celebrating the 100th birthday of vibraphonist and bandleader Terry Gibbs, who's just released a newly uncovered recording of the Terry Gibbs Dream Band, Volume 7, The Lost Tapes, from 1959. And Terry, this album features some of the great arrangers of that era, Bill Holman, Med Flory, Marty Paich, Bob Brookmeyer, and others. And it reminds me that when you grew up in Brooklyn, you were surrounded by some of the great, you know, young musicians who would go on to have fabulous careers.
Oh, yeah. Johnny Mandel and Alcoa, Manny Album, Frank Sokolow, Tiny Kong, Davy Shilcrowd, who played with Stryker. Yeah, Chuck Wayne. A bunch of these guys became heavyweight players. You know, you fight each other. You know, as young kids, you hear about a guy in this neighborhood who can play it. And because you want to play with the best guy, you want to play with guys better than you, so you can learn. But it's why with bebop, I came home on a furlough. The name Tiny Khan is not known to many people, but he was the guy that we all learned from. I grew up with Tiny from 6 years old till 19. We were together day and night. He weighed about 320 pounds. He's about 6'4".
And they called him Tiny?
Anyhow, we looked like Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet walking down the street. That's what we looked like growing up. But he was so talented. If Johnny Mandel was alive and you asked him where he learned to swing, right swing, he would tell you Tiny Khan. Manny Album would tell you Khan. Al Cole would tell you Tiny Khan. Everybody that grew up in New York. But anyhow, I was going to tell you, I come home from furlough because Tiny couldn't go to the Army. I told him, so he says, you got to hear a new music called bebop. Now, I had all this technique. I was a classically trained xylophone player. I had all this technique, but my idols were Roy Eldridge and Lester Young. And they played very simple, so that's when I stopped playing drums. I was Tiny and I played the same style. I went and played drums. I was in the Army. I played with a 38-piece orchestra making Army movie pictures. And then when I came home, I furloughed Tiny. You got to hear bebop. I said, what does bebop mean? So he took me down to hear Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, Max Roach, and Curly Russell, one band. I had a slight nervous breakdown. I say slight, I'm not kidding about this, because all of a sudden I found something that I've been looking for all my life. There was a movie picture where they found Shangri-La, you know. Well, I found Shangri-La with what I heard, but I didn't believe what I heard. And I could play technically, so I wanted to play like the articulation, the whole way they played. And so I went back in the Army. You know, we had a few drummers. We used to have a little jam session with a bunch of new jazz players. I came back in the Army playing 4 million notes. The first one was always right, and the last one was always right. Whatever I played in the middle, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I when I got out of service, it only took me a few years to catch on to the language, and I became one of the bebop players, you know?
Well, you certainly did, and, you know, you have many associations over that period with some of the greats, from Benny Goodman, and Buddy Rich was a pretty close friend of yours.
Yeah, he was. I worked in his band to start with. We used to fight all guys. But he was close. I'm going to tell you this one story. The day before he died, there was a very rich guy called Sam Alessi who loved Buddy Rich and took Buddy Rich's whole hospital bed, nurses and all, hired them all, and brought him to his house and put him in one of his rooms. And the day before he died, Ray Brown and I went out to see him, and that was it. The next day I get a call from Mel Torme that Buddy Rich died. And I have to play the funeral. I said, what do you mean I got to play the funeral? It was his will for you, Ray Brown, and Harry Sweet Sanderson to play. And they couldn't find the other two guys. So now I had to play the funeral, and now there are about five or six guys who are going to talk. First, Mel Torme spoke, as well as his relationship, how he got Buddy. And then Johnny Carson, he really had everybody almost in tears. It was a close funeral, about 100 people. He loved Buddy Rich. If you ever saw the Johnny Carson show, he was on a million times. But you know, Johnny liked to play the drums.
Yes, he did.
So anyhow, so Johnny had everybody crying. And Frank Sinatra got up. It was no big line. He said, "You know, when I joined the Tommy Dorsey band, and Buddy Rich is already there, Tommy said, now I have two ass on the band." We didn't believe it. You know, it was just everybody just broke up. And then Audie Shaw, by the way, speaks his mind. He don't care who he insults or whatever it is. He says it like it is to him. Like one time they asked him, "What's the difference between your playing and Benny Goodman playing?" That's when they were both battling for everything. He says, "Well, Benny Goodman played the clarinet and I played music." So he said that to Prince, put him down. And so now he's talking about Buddy Rich. He says, "You know, when Buddy played my band, he played loud bass drum. The coffin is about 4 feet away from him. And he says, you know, I heard him play 6 months ago. And you know what? He was still playing loud bass drum. The man put it down." But it was like a Broadway show. And then Jerry Lewis spoke. And then the last person was Robert Blake, the guy.
The actor, Robert Blake.
Yeah, Robert Blake. He read a poem that Jack Jones wrote. And it was pretty much. And then everybody left. And, you know, Buddy and I used to fight about who plays faster. And all I had to do was play the song by Buddy. And I had to hold my right hand with my left hand. So I just played just a few first few notes. And while this is going on, Jackie Cooper, the actor, who was a friend of mine, was in the back of me. He and I were both crying like two idiots.
Well, you got to know a lot of these Hollywood, titans through your work in television as well.
Every comedian in the world, really.
Well, what are some of your recollections working with Steve Allen, for example, and Regis Philbin?
I'll tell you my first meeting with Regis Philbin. I left California, went back to New York to start a new life again. And 2 years later, I get a call from one of the producers of the Steve Allen show. I used to appear there as a guest all the time. And I get a call from him saying, "Listen, Steve just quit the Westinghouse and we got this young kid in San Diego who's going to come in and do the show. His name is Regis Philbin. Would you like to conduct a television show?" I said, "Dick, you know, I never conducted a show." He said, "You'll be great. Don't worry about it." So he said, "But you gotta come and audition. Not play. We just want to see what kind of rapport you're going to have with Regis, because you're going to be like the second banana." So they flew me in. I came in, and they brought me into a room with the executive producer and Regis. And nobody's saying a word, you know. Like, so I just broke the ice. "You know something, Regis, you got the dumbest name, Regis. What comes first, Regis or Philbin?" And you know what? He broke up, and now I got hired to do that show.
Wow. And working with Steve Allen, now that was a jazz lover.
Yeah. Steve was my friend when I met, I think, at the Royal Roost in New York. He was just doing a radio show. And he asked me, I play two-finger piano, and so he asked me if I would come up and do his radio show. It's from 6 in the morning or something, 4 in the morning it is. And we, you know, in New York, you play at 4 o'clock in the morning. I said, yeah. So I went up there, and we're not comedians. We were sort of willing. We just say what comes up. I can't act. I can't be anybody but myself. It's got to come out of my mouth, the words. Steve's the same way. He used to add them on scripted shows when I was conducting him. So we got to be friends. Then he'd come in the club and I taught him how to play the vibe. Then later on in life, after I was conducting Operation Entertainment, I was off a little bit. He said to me, "I'm going to Vegas. I'm putting a show together. would you like to be in a show? But we could close the show with you playing vibes, and I got rhythm, where you play piano and vibes, play a ballad, and we'll do the vibe duet. I said, yeah. So then I asked him, I said, who's conducting the show? He says, well, the house band leader. I said, I would sure love to conduct that show because I hate to sit around for an hour and a half until the end of this, you know, end of the show. And so he said, well, I can't pay any more money if you want to. I said, yeah, I want to do it. So I was conducting the show, and I was good to him because I would, Steve is the type of guy, if he said something funny about a waitress dropping a tray, he never insults anybody. If he said something about whatever it was today, and the next day, that same situation come up, and I would yell, but how about the tray? He's, oh yeah, tray, and then say something completely different. He don't remember what he said last night. He just, it's, his mind works that way. He's not a comedian. He's a wit. At rehearsal, whatever he rehearsed, he would change it in the show when it came showtime. He was the most fun to work with because he loved jazz, you know.
You also became known for, you know, your versatility working in non-jazz situations, including a session for John Lennon, of all people.
That was John Lennon and Phil Spector at the same time.
Well, there's two quite strong personalities.
You know something? I have to be there. You know, I don't work, do studio days. I don't do them at all. That's not my bag. But I was home about 10 o'clock at night, and I get a call from the drummer who was working with Frankie Camp. He said, Terry, we're recording John Lennon and Phil needs a, wants a violin player. There's no violin player. I'm the only percussion player here. I said, Frank, I don't do days. Call Abel Richards. Call this guy. You know, he called me back, and he said, we can't get it. Also, Phil Spector gets on the phone. He's singing Steve Allen's theme song. Steve Allen, Terry, get it with Steve Allen. Come on down, I'll give you 10 doubles. Now, you know what 10 doubles are, Dave?
No, tell me.
10 salaries.
Wow.
Whatever the scale, 10 salaries. And when he goes past 12 o'clock, it's double time that. So anyhow, I went down, and the first thing I walk in, I took a deep breath and got stoned out. Everybody was smoking pot. And John Lennon was surrounded by about 9 Japanese girls. And I heard Phil Spector go and say, take 45. And I'm listening while I'm walking over to where the percussion section. And I said to Frank, did you just play this piece of garbage 45 times? I said, it's a piece of garbage. He said, well, Phil has to hear something he wants. Anyhow, I said, what do I play? He said, I've been playing Bob, Bob, Bada. I said, wait a second. Did you call me here to go Bob, Bob, Bada? I said, my grandmother could have come and done the show. Well, he said, well, Phil wanted you. So anyhow, we went about take 85. You won't believe it. 4 o'clock in the morning, we're done, and all of a sudden, he said, okay, Phil said, that's a wrap. That's good. So now they wheel in a birthday cake the size of, let me see, 8 foot,
no.
8 feet. Well, all of a sudden, they wheel it in. All of a sudden, I see John Lennon running to the cake and dived into it. He died in the pool. And Phil took out his gun and started shooting to the ceiling. I got scared and ran under the piano. I looked like a bunch of crazy idiots. And Al Plain, the drummer, came on, he's a friend, came on the piano. He said, they do this all the time. Come on, I'll tell you. They do this all the time.
Well, Terry Gibbs, I'm sure you have scores of other stories just like this throughout your illustrious career in music. And congratulations again on the release of the Terry Gibbs Dream Band, Volume 7, The Lost Tapes. And once more, happy birthday. Thanks for joining us on Inside Art.
Thank you very much. It was fun just talking about it.
a newly discovered recording of the Terry Gibbs Dream Band, Volume 7, The Lost Tapes from 1959, is now available from Wailing City Sound at WailingCitySound.com and wherever music is sold. You can learn more about Terry Gibbs online at TerryGibbs.net. Inside Art is made possible with support from the members of Jazz 88.3. Replays and extended versions of every Inside Art broadcast are available online at jazz88.org/insideart. Again, my thanks to Terry Gibbs. For Jazz 88.3, I'm Dave Drexler. Join me again on air and online for another edition of Inside Art. Breaking Jazz is next.